Welcome to Life Quest, a program that directs you to subjects and books that will make a difference in your life. A program that will make you think and strengthen your journey of faith in the 21st century. My name is Dwight Lainhoff. Today on Life Quest, I'm talking with James Carroll. He is a distinguished writer in residence at the Center for European and Mediterranean Studies at New York University. He's the author of 11 novels and 7 works of nonfiction. And today I'm talking with him about his latest book, which is called Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. James, welcome to LifeQuest.
Thank you. It's my privilege to be with you.
Why did you write this book at this time?
Well, this book, the title of it, Christ Actually, is a quote from the Lutheran pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was murdered by the Nazis. He died hanged in a Nazi cell at the end of World War II. And he looked around at the Nazi assault on the Jewish people and the church complicity in that assault and asked almost despairingly, who is Christ actually, given all that's going on around us, mm-hmm. in the name of Christ? And for me, I admit it, the Holocaust is a kind of generating problem. I've been, as a Catholic Christian, all these years trying to reckon with how my church was complicit in that great crime. And the long tradition of Christian anti-Judaism, mm-hmm. which generated racial anti-Semitism, requires us to look again at who Jesus was. And, of course, the starting point of our reexamination has to be that he was a Jew. If we hadn't forgotten that in some deep way, the history of the last 2,000 years would be very different. So Christ actually, for me, begins with a real re-examination of the meaning of his having been fully and completely a Jew. From the birth to the death, a Jew, nothing but a Jew.
You take a concept from Bonhoeffer, who seems to be saying that religion and Jesus Christ aren't identical. Can you unpack that a little bit?
Well, of course, he gave us the basic idea of what's so-called religionless Christianity, arguing that in some way the modern era, both the moral failures of the 20th century, but also the intellectual revolution of the scientific age, had undercut some basic religious ideas. Mm-hmm. Who is God? We talk about God as if we know God, as if God is an object who can be examined, and yet God is the mystery beyond our capacity to know anything real or in particular at all. And Bonhoeffer used this phrase, the God beyond God. So it's the idea that religious language has failed us, and we're having to find new ways not to abandon the tradition, but to understand it. Which is why I think we return to the Gospels, read them freshly with an eye on how they were written, when they were written, and for whom they were written, and understand their core meaning. And in that case, we find a very fresh and powerful new arrival of Jesus, the man for others, a phrase of Bonhoeffer's, Jesus who was wholly aligned with the poor and the misfits, and Jesus, who was, above all, a man of peace, the Prince of Peace, who said no to violence. It was when the church began to forget that Jesus that our trouble started, that we embraced, for example, the tradition in Christianity of the Holy War.
Yes.
And it was that embrace that spawned right into our own time the idea that we can somehow destroy the world in the name of trying to save it, which is, of course, the basic idea of nuclear deterrence.
Yes.
So these obscure religious ideas actually have a profound present relevance.
Often Christians, the average lay Christian and also theologians, tend to look at the Jewishness of Jesus through the Gospels and the Gospel story. But you're suggesting that there's so much more than that. You talk about the Dead Sea Scrolls and talking about, wow, the various Holocausts, not just the one in the ones in the 20th century, but way back to various things in the time of Christ, who was facing that sort of thing, the Jewish community was at the time of Jesus.
Well, so we can't really understand the text if we don't understand the context. And the context for the Gospels was the Roman War against the Jews, which, yes, I call the First Holocaust,
mm-hmm.
because the Romans killed, scholars tell us now, something over 1 million, maybe 2 million Jews in a three-phased war that unfolded just as the Gospels were being written. And that war influenced the story that we read in the Gospels. The conflict in the Gospels between Jesus and the group called, quote, the Jews, unquote, basically lets the Romans off the hook,
yeah.
who were the real antagonist of Jesus. The Romans murdered Jesus, not the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Well, why do the Gospels tell a story that seems to exonerate the Romans? Pontius Pilate, a good guy, almost. And the answer is the Roman War at that time, exactly then. And the Romans destroyed the Temple of Jerusalem in the year 70, causing a crisis of faith for every Jew, including the Jesus people. What is it to be a Jew without the temple?
Yes.
The answer came in two ways. One, Jews said, now the temple is Jesus. They were the Jesus people,
mm-hmm.
eventually the church. And the other answer was, now more than ever, the temple is the study of Torah and observance of the law.
Mm-hmm.
And they became the rabbis. These two groups of Jews eventually became antagonists. Their conflict is what we see in the gospel. And we therefore know not to read the conflict in the gospel literally. The context tells us to read the text in ways that are not taking them literally, so that when we read that in Matthew, the, quote, Jews, unquote, cried out, let his blood be upon us and upon our children,
mm-hmm.
we're ready to understand that did not happen. Therefore, the long tradition of blood libels against the Jewish people
yes.
was an offense against who Jesus was.
I remember at university having an assignment of reading Rabbi Richard Rubinstein's book after Auschwitz and writing a report on it. And I had a hard time, the teacher told me. And I also found it very depressive or negative in the sense that the rabbi is saying, well, after Auschwitz, we really can't look at God the same way as Jewish people. That really seems to have affected not only Jews, but Christians.
It's true. I mean, that Rubinstein's insight is crucial for Jews and Christians alike. The Auschwitz was an interruption. Auschwitz and all that it symbolizes was an interruption in history. And it was a revelation of some basic dynamic at the heart of Western culture going back 2,000 years. For Jews, it raised one set of questions. But for Christians, it raises another very pointed set of questions about what we believe about Jesus, which was Bonhoeffer's point. And the good news is that since the Holocaust, Christians have been reckoning with this
mm-hmm.
revelation. I'm a Catholic. In the Catholic tradition, the Second Vatican Council renounced the Christ killer charge, which was the kernel of anti-Semitism.
Mm-hmm.
And the Second Vatican Council affirmed the ongoing permanence of the covenant God has made with the people Israel, which is another element of anti-Judaism, thinking that God has somehow rejected the people Israel. Well, Christians have moved away from that theology, and it took the Holocaust to make them do it. That's an example of how the Holocaust and what symbolizes it so powerfully, Auschwitz, has caused.
I want to jump back to the Holocausts that happened. And I guess somewhere in my education, I didn't really grasp what happened under Hadrian in the center of your book here in 8135. And how that Jerusalem, in one sense, was being eradicated from identity.
Well, that's a hugely important point, Mr. Lenhoff, and I'll just remind your listeners of the context again. So the war the Romans waged against the Jews unfolded in three phases. first in 70, second in the year 115, and thirdly in the year 135.
Mm-hmm.
By then, almost about 100 years after the death of Jesus. And in the Bar Kokhba revolt of 135,
yes,
the Romans, led by Hadrian, savaged the people of Judea, and they basically totally destroyed the city of Jerusalem, renamed it Aelia Capitolina, said that Jerusalem would never be heard of again, and that banished the Jews from the city of Jerusalem forever. And that set in motion this tradition that we know to this day of the Jews in diaspora. The Jews were people without a homeland until 1948, and that began in 135 with the destruction of Jerusalem. And that, of course, had a profound impact on the relations between Jews and Christians,
mm-hmm,
because the center of the Christian movement that was faithfully Jewish and understood the Jewishness of Jesus and his movement, that element in the Christian tradition was destroyed, leading to the dominance after that of Gentiles in the Jesus movement, who did not know, who found it easy to forget that Jesus himself was fully and permanently a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
And once that began to happen, it became possible, even easy, for Christians to begin to think of Jews as the enemy, not just of Jesus, but of God. And once Jews were regarded by Christians as God's enemy, as the deicide people, the murderers of God, it became possible to begin to treat Jews with contempt, a tradition that morphed over the centuries into anti-Semitism and ultimately,
yes,
into the Holocaust. So it all begins, in a way, with that year, 135.
Yeah. Somewhere in far too prodigious reading, I came across Hitler's book Mein Kampf, in which he said we shouldn't think of Jesus as a Jew, but as one who freed us from Jewish domination or something like that, which seems to me to be
the ultimate. Yeah, that is the ultimate. That's an extreme version of what was a widespread Christian habit, which was thinking of Jesus as an Aryan or thinking of Jesus as a Northern European.
Yes.
I mean, I remember Bible story books in my childhood in which Jesus had flowing,
right,
brown hair and, you know, didn't look Semitic at all.
Exactly.
And that sort of purging of the Jewishness of Jesus was a common European impulse. And it was related to this really quite dangerous impulse to forget that Jesus himself was Jewish. And if we hadn't forgotten that, the history of the last 2,000 years would be very different.
If you just tuned in, I'm talking with James Carroll. He's the author of a book, Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age. James, in the middle of your book, I appreciated very much your dealing with Jesus at Nazareth when he stands up in his home church and he reads from the scroll of Isaiah. And then you talk about his relationship with John the Baptist. But talk a little bit to us about what happened there in Nazareth when Jesus said, "The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me."
Well, it's a very beautiful story. Starting with the relationship between John the Baptist and Jesus, we can think of John the Baptist as the mentor of Jesus. We don't,
mm-hmm,
know enough, we don't know a lot about John the Baptist, but we know that he was a radical Jewish prophet. Jesus calls him a prophet. And we know that Jesus was devoted to him. Jesus had his first recorded encounter with his heavenly Father when John the Baptist baptized him, and the heavens opened, and Jesus had an experience of God declaring him to be his beloved son. So John the Baptist was hugely important to Jesus. And John the Baptist, because he spoke truth to power, was thrown in prison and was in danger of being executed by Herod.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's at that point that Jesus is reported to have gone into the synagogue in his hometown and read from the prophecy of Isaiah, in which, among other things, Isaiah announces not just healing to the sick and relief to the poor, but freedom to prisoners. And the point you're referring to is, in Jesus' reading, he includes freedom to prisoners. But when later the disciples of John the Baptist come to Jesus and ask Jesus if he is the one they're looking for, can John the Baptist trust him, depend on him, Jesus cites Isaiah again, but without referring to freedom for prisoners, which was, I take it, to mean that Jesus could not free John the Baptist. He was basically saying, this is the limit of what I can do. I can't lead an army and stage a jailbreak for you. I can't save your life, much as I wish I could. It's, in a way, it's Jesus confronting the limits of his situation. So we shouldn't think of Jesus as a sort of God-man who could do anything he wanted. If he could do anything he wanted, he surely would have freed John the Baptist. But he was reckoning with what he, with what our faith in the God-made man really means, that he completely accepted life in the human condition, fully limited by it. And that's a crucial element in our faith in Jesus. He was one of us completely.
It seems to me, James, also, that Jesus was redefining for John the Baptist the concept of who the Messiah was when he said to the disciples, go back to him and tell him what you saw today as Jesus taught and healed and that sort of thing, and didn't lead an army.
It's true. He doesn't lead an army, and by invoking Isaiah, he's also reminding us of Isaiah's vision of the suffering servant, that this is not going to be a man of power, but a man associated with powerlessness, and predicting, in effect, his own suffering that would mark his journey to Jerusalem.
James, what does this all mean for the Christian today?
Well, we're living after two major changes. One, moral, the Holocaust, the failure of the Christian churches to oppose Hitler. And two, intellectual, the revolutions of the scientific age. And Christian faith, reckoning with its moral limits and having to recast itself intellectually, is in the process of becoming renewed in a very beautiful and positive way. Our understanding of who God is and of who Jesus is undergoing a profound change. We see it everywhere we look. Human beings are desperate for new sources of meaning, as the threat to the planet, as the vast gulf between the rich and the poor, the desperate populations of the earth. What is it to be a human being on the earth? And the new language that we have about God and about love of the neighbor is a renewal of the Christian tradition. So it's a very good and positive and hopeful time, even if it has been generated, thinking again of Bonhoeffer, by a profound Christian failure that culminated in the Holocaust, but began when Christians began to demonize the Jewish people of Jesus.
Again, the book is Christ Actually, Reimagining Faith in the Modern Age by James Carroll. James, when and where can people get copies of this book?
Well, the book is out and available wherever good books are sold. They can learn more about it and about me from my website, jamescarroll.net. And I look forward to your listeners taking advantage of your fine conversation with me to read this book, and I hope to benefit from it.
James, thank you for being on LifeQuest.
Mr. Lenoff, it's been my privilege. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to LifeQuest today. If you have questions or comments, you may send them to lifequest@lifetalk.net. My name is Dwight Lanehoff. This program comes to you from studios in the Meadowglade Church, Battleground, Washington.